I want to welcome Paul M. from Riverside, Illinois.
Thank you, Rita. Good evening. Chuck didn't have it right. I don't mind if you smoke as long as you don't exhale. I did get a little ahead of myself. I'm not going to be sober 50 years until August 15th, but I never know if I'm going to live that long. Through the grace of God and the AA program, I haven't had a drink or a pill or an impure thought since August 15th, 1947. Judy and I have had a very nice time here and appreciate everybody's hospitality. Judy and I met in a travel agency. She was looking for the last resort. I feel kind of like Elizabeth Taylor's next husband. I know it's expected of me, but I can't figure out how to make it interesting. As you know, I've been sober a long time. When I sobered up, Dr. Ruth was still a virgin. For years, I was worried about dying young, and now it's too late. A while back, I stayed in one of those motels that has a mirror on the ceiling. And I woke up in the morning, and I looked up, and I thought I was being attacked by a giant prune. I came into AA when I was 25. I'm 75 now, which is a lot older than I planned to be. It's only 24 on the Celsius scale. I'm an adult child of an Amway salesman. I did a lot of different things for a living after I sobered up. I've had a lot of problems understanding that I'm not as smart as I always thought I was. But I ended up writing for a living. And a while back, I travel a lot out of the country, Latin America, Europe, Asia, and so forth, is just part of the work. I have trouble remembering where I am sometimes. I'm starting to develop alcoholic Alzheimer's. That's when you forget everything but the resentments. The Galapagos Islands are 600 miles west of Ecuador in the Pacific. It's where Darwin got the idea for the theory of evolution from studying the finches and the giant tortoises. And the giant tortoises get to be 500 and 600 pounds. And I learned that during mating season, the male tortoises get so excited they try to mate with large rocks. It's pretty much like your average AA picnic. Appreciate everybody's hospitality. Chuck and Katie have been very nice to us. You probably don't know, Chuck turned out very well when he was a kid. He was so ugly, his mother used to tie a pork chop around his neck so the dog would play with him. Going to meetings and not drinking do not treat my alcoholism. Working the 12 steps treats my alcoholism. If all I do is go to meetings and not drink, eventually, I suffer from untreated alcoholism, which comes out as depression, anxiety, hostility, fear, apathy, and all of those other symptoms, which are almost inevitable if I quit drinking and don't do anything about myself. The steps of the program, it's not an individual program. It says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Recovery obviously means a great deal more than just not drinking. It means that I start to become sane and begin to lose my character defects, which have been very slow in departing. It means that I continue to need the help of the people in the group I belong to where I go on every Wednesday night in LaGrange. It's a working step group. It's not a talking step group. It's not a reading step group. It's not a philosophizing step group. It's a group that will enable me to continue to experience what the program offers, but only if I continue to do those things that the program demands. How it works is very specific. I think that if we listened carefully to that, we would probably all run out and begin to work the steps almost instantly. What we try to do in our group, which as I say is a working step group, we take one step each week, we go from 1 up to 12, and then we go back to 1, and we do this over and over. And the idea is that we continue to work these steps. The idea is that any stage of sobriety, I find the help that I need within the 12 steps by continuing to do what the program demands. Dr. Harry Thiebaud was a psychiatrist who came in touch with AA when AA was just beginning. He was trying to treat Marty Mann, who was the first woman in AA, and she got a hold of a copy of the manuscript of the book before it was published. She showed it to Thiebaud and said, "What do you think?" And he probably said, "Well, it certainly can't hurt anything. Why don't you go?" And Thiebaud became quite interested in studying the alcoholic and the alcoholic ego. Somebody has said that the ego is like a baby. It has a tremendous appetite on one end and no sense of responsibility on the other. And he said that surrender is a disciplinary function. All of us, when we finally decide to quit drinking, say, "I'll do anything to stay sober." And then a few weeks later, we say, "I'll do almost anything to stay sober." And then a few weeks later, see, we say, "Wait a minute, this is an individual program." And what Thiebaud said was that one inventory is not sufficient. We have to continue to do this. Because in order to stay surrendered and to stay amenable to the teachings of the program, the ego has to be disciplined and reduced. I have a lot of trouble. I was always a victim before AA. I was a victim of a cruel and unfriendly universe. And when I came into AA, they said, "You're responsible for your own life." I thought, boy, that's very unfair. And I finally began to understand that if I'm responsible for the condition of my life, then if I change, my life will change. And that's what I began to try to do. Somebody has said that the phrase in the Bible, "the meek shall inherit the earth," was mistranslated, that the word praos, which was translated as meek, really means trained or disciplined. And I think we are trained and disciplined by continuing to work and rework every one of the 12 steps. I don't think it's accidental. I think it's very, very specific. I've had a lot of trouble being honest in my life. That's why at 50, incidentally, I lied to you. I'm not sober since I did, as I mentioned, miss a couple of weeks. I'll be sober August 15th, 50 years. But when I came into AA, I was willing to do anything that they told me to do. And I had a sponsor who didn't tell me what to do, and I couldn't figure out what to do. So I got into some very dishonest business because I've always had a tremendous amount of greed without a comparable amount of talent to satisfy the greed. And I was sober about a year, and I was in real bad trouble with the law, sober. And I went to some friends, and I said, "Maybe I missed something in this program." They said, "Son, you missed the whole program." They said, "You kept such an open mind that the whole program just blew right through." So I read chapter 5. I'd heard about the big book somewhere or other. And I read it, and it said, "Do an inventory." And a little while later, I did my first fifth step. And suddenly, I understood something about the program and God and you that I had never understood before. I come from a long line of Lutheran ministers. In spite of that fact, I believe in God today. The way I was brought up, they said that if you don't believe this way, you're going to be part of an eternal marshmallow roast, and you're liable to be one of the marshmallows. And when I would say why, they would say, "That's because God loves you." And I gradually concluded I could live better with a little less cosmic affection. And I became an atheist and an agnostic. It depended how I felt each day. I was an atheist. I was a pilot in the Navy in World War II. And I had a spell there where I was an atheist. And one night I cracked up an airplane, and I'm out there in the water waiting for some people to find me. And you never heard such loud prayers in your whole life. Atheism really disappeared in a hurry. But what Thiebaud said in my experience is very, very true. My ego will come back very, very quickly. I'm at my worst when everything is going well and I'm getting everything I want. And at my best when my life is smashed. So I have to stick with these people who will tell me the truth about myself. These people who will help me to be honest and understand reality as it applies to me. I got into the writing business at quite an advanced age. Charlie, you should still be a writer. You're never too old. Charlie's talk did have an effect. I tell you, a couple got married over there. And I shaved extra close tonight. But I sobered up, and I had done some boxing before I sobered up, and I decided to be a professional wrestler, which was not something for which I was. Did that for about 3 years. Then in the early 50s, I started working on overseas construction. I worked in Greenland, Iceland, and Alaska. I went up as a laborer on a rigging crew. I worked in Alaska in 56 and 7. I was airport manager in Point Barrow. It's while they were building the distant early warning lines. And the dew line up there, when I was drinking, a lot of people told me I was a smart young fellow, and if I would quit drinking, I'd go far. But northern Greenland was quite a bit farther than I had intended to go. But I'd always wanted to write. I was an English major in college. I would have made Phi Beta Kappa if it hadn't been for my grades. But I never tried it, because one thing AA has done, it's given me the courage to fail. I never wanted to try to be a writer because I figured I'm going to be lousy, and I don't want anybody to know that. I would rather spend the rest of my life talking about what a great writer I would have been if I'd have ever tried it. So I came back around the Chicago area in the late 1950s, and I got a job with the trade association. They just put me to work writing. I was 37 years old. I can't imagine why. Then I worked in a PR agency, and I was marketing director of a manufacturing company. And in 1966, I went into business for myself, writing magazine articles and doing PR and those kinds of things for people. And an interesting thing happened. I failed over and over and over. And I came to understand that if somebody tells me I wrote a lousy article, and a lot of people did, it doesn't mean that I'm a lousy human being. I have to learn to separate that from that. My being is determined by what I do with the 12 steps on a continuing basis. I've always exercised. I go to the gym 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and I'm in a lot better physical condition as a result. I'm in better spiritual condition if I continue to work and rework the 12 steps. I spent a lot of time with hyperactive AA activities. I got back from Greenland and Iceland and Alaska in the late 1950s, and a lot of things had changed since I left there after I sobered up. They were having conferences, they were having banquets, they had delegates to New York and those kinds of things, and I became a delegate to New York, and I ran everything I could get my hands on, talked all over the country. And if you ever see anybody doing that, and he gives you any reason except ego, pride, and recognition, you want to watch him, because he'll lie to you about other things too. But I had a strange experience around home, because a lot of people didn't understand God's will when I explained it to them. And I pushed a lot of them around to get my own way. And when I was sober 21 years, 1968, after a meeting, I was talking to a couple of people. One of them was a boy I sponsored who was sober about 3 years. And I had really worked him out with the first 9 steps. He had done them and done a great job. And I told the people, I said, you know, I don't feel as good as I should. And this guy said, why don't you write out a new 8th step and go around and make amends to these people? Which is not what I planned on hearing. I thought that was rather poor advice to give to one of AA's leaders. But I found 12 names on there, and I went around and made amends to those people, and of course my life changed. I have to be in an area, in a community of AA where they work and rework the steps. I spent a tremendous amount of time, as I said, confusing activity with action, running in all directions and doing all kinds of things, and not doing the continuing action in the 12 steps. We have chapter 5, 6, and 7, and they pretty well explain what we're supposed to do with the 12 steps. And chapter 6 says, into action. And the action is strictly working the 12 steps with ourselves and then the sponsorship chapter, working it with another person. Those of you who heard Craig yesterday morning talk about sponsorship heard a tremendous talk, because he went specifically through what we do with a new person. Now, what we do in our group is we work with them very quickly, because what we try to replicate is what they were doing when AA began. And when AA started, they didn't say you can't take a fourth and fifth step for 6 months or 5 years or whatever. They did that right away. They got the new person right into working the steps, which is why AA had such a tremendous burst of growth in those early years. If they had waited 5 years, we'd have never had AA. Dr. Bob had the first slip in 1935. He was sober a few weeks and he got drunk. The day he sobered up, he went out all over Akron making amends to people to whom he owed them, because he felt that this was probably why he got drunk, because he had missed this part of the program. So that's what we try to do in the group I go to, and it helps me to continue to do these things. Late last year, I remembered something that as a result of going to a meeting, I think it was either on step 9 or step 10. As I say, I've written for a lot of different magazines through the years. I've written some books. I'm going to work on one on vegetarianism with Mike Tyson. But there was an editor I'd sold 5-6 years ago. I'd sold her some articles. And I've done a lot of interview articles for various publications. I've done a lot of political interviews for the American Legion magazine. President Cristiani of El Salvador, Chamorro of Nicaragua, Judge Bork, people like that. In this magazine, I did a lot of interviews with entertainment people. And if I was doing them in person, I was supposed to get more money. And I did some not in person, which would have been for less money, except I lied to the lady. And this is with only 49 years of sobriety. So as you can see, this hair didn't fall out. It was beaten on. So I called her up and I told her what I'd done. I said, I think the difference is $1,600. I want to send you a check for $1,600. I lied to you and I'm sorry that happened. She said, no, just forget it. I don't want the money. I said, no, I owe you the money. I want to send it. She says, no, I don't want it. Don't take it. So that day I wrote out $1,600 worth of checks for charities to make sure that I couldn't change my mind. But well, I might mention that again later on. You know, I was in a meeting one time in 1961 in the spring. We were having a conference in Chicago. And it was Sunday afternoon. The Sunday afternoon speaker started about 2 o'clock, and we had about 600 people there. And it was in a banquet hall. And a man came in with his wife, and somebody ushered him over to some seats. And after the guy finished, he came over to me, and he said, you know, I don't belong to this, but he said, I need something like this. So he said, what do you mean? He said, well, I ought to quit drinking. He said, does this work? I said, absolutely. So he started going to meetings. He got drunk once after that, and he stayed sober the rest of his life. But this was the spring of 61, and he and his wife had come in there just to look at the hall because his daughter was getting married, and they were going to use this for a reception, and they wanted to see what it was like. He said that for 30 days before that, he had been praying for some way to quit drinking. And this is what happened. We always called him the accidental alcoholic. But Charlie mentioned Clint last night. Clint's a very good guy. I've known him for a number of years. But interestingly, Clint, I think, is sober 31 years. But as Clint has said in his more recent talks, he didn't do a really decent job with the 12 steps for the first 24 years he was sober. And as he also says, he suffered severely from untreated alcoholism in his life. And Clint was very active, as I was very active before I finally figured out that how it works means that this is how it works. And that's why I continue to go to that home group. I think that AA is of itself sufficient. In the spring of 1948, sober less than a year, I heard Paul Stanley talk in Chicago. He was the number 5 AA from Akron. And over in his talk, Stanley said, AA is of itself sufficient. And I was not sure that that was correct. Today, I believe that is correct. AA is of itself sufficient. We have something that's arisen called relapse prevention. Now, we used to have slips in AA. Now we have relapses. A relapse is a slip that happens to an alcoholic who has insurance that will pay for generally useless treatment. If I want to prevent a slip, the best way is to follow the directions. Do what it says. And as far as I can see today, everything that Paul Stanley said that Sunday morning in 1948 is absolutely correct. Because AA speaks to my condition at any stage of sobriety. I was very fortunate to be a guest in Bill Wilson's home on several occasions. 1951, I went over there. A friend who knew him well took me over to the house. And Lois Wilson at that time was a wrestling fan. And I used to work on the shows out of Rainbow Arena in Chicago on Wednesday night. So there was Lois watching me cavort around the ring. She recovered from it. But I think we're uniquely and just tremendously fortunate that we had people like Doc Bill and Dr. Bob who started this thing and put it together. Can you imagine if you and I were trying to sober up today and we didn't have these 12 steps, we didn't have this fellowship, this community, we didn't have all this knowledge which has been accumulated. I also think it's very interesting that our co-founder, Dr. Bob, was a proctologist. I think that tells us very clearly which end of the alcoholic the higher power thought was more important. I think it's also interesting that Bill Wilson had his spiritual experience after he worked the first 8 steps of the program with the help of Ebby in November of 1934. That's what happened. He did the first 8 steps with Ebby within the first week or so of being sober. And then he had that spiritual experience, and from that, AA has grown. Earl Treat started AA in Chicago, and this is the kind of sponsorship that we try to do in the group I belong to. Earl Treat started AA in Chicago, and he went down and lived with Dr. Bob for 3 weeks in Akron. And Bob, though these steps were not written in their present form at that time, Bob took him through the equivalent of the first 8 steps of the program, up to amends, up to step 9. And Earl went back and started AA in 1939, where it's probably 20 or 30,000 members in the area at this point. But that's what Bob did with Earl, and that was sponsorship. And that, to my mind, is what sponsorship always should be, working the 12 steps. I was sober 16 years, and I had done one go-through with the first 9 steps. Because the area in which I came into AA, Oak Park, a suburb of Chicago, everybody said that you work the first 9 steps once and then you do 10, 11, and 12. And I suffered from that familiar misconception for many years because I didn't know any better. And I see people who still, unfortunately, believe that. The only way you can understand whether reworking all of the steps will work is if you try it. In 1963, I ran into a guy who was a psychologist at the University of Illinois, Dr. Hobart Maurer. And Maurer was world famous for his work in learning theory. And he was a research professor of psychology there. And he was interested in, well, he had been a strict Freudian. And then he found out that nobody ever got better with Freudian analysis. And he thought maybe there was something wrong with it. So he began to study the work of a guy named Harry Stack Sullivan. And Sullivan said, we break down because we have lived dishonestly, irresponsibly, selfishly, secretly. And the way to get straightened out is to become thoroughly honest, thoroughly responsible, and open with many, many people. Because I think all of us come into AA with secrets, and we're as sick as our secrets. If I want to get better, if I let everybody know all the truth about me, I'm free in a way that I could never be before. And as of 1963, I had only taken 1/4 and 1/5 step. So I started doing it on the belief that I could only understand it if I did it. And I began to see that opening up with more and more people freed me in ways that never would happen otherwise. And that's another thing we do in our group. We work extensively with continuing work with the steps. And another thing I learned from Maurer was that if somebody comes to me to take a 5th step with me, I take a thorough 5th step with him, with a written inventory, so that when we get done, we're even. If you're sober a long time, it's easy to become a guru. I spent a lot of time looking for a guru and a lot more time trying to convince people that I was a guru. Incidentally, in our group, we believe that men should take fifth steps with men and women should take fifth steps with women, we find that working on that basis, there is less tendency to generate new material that requires additional fourth and fifth steps. But I found that really started me off again on the program, because one of the things that happens if I swap a fifth step with a person and he gets to know all about me, it's very tough to play guru. There's a big guru market in AA, and one of the things we try to make sure in our group is that we are all on the same level. I did a lot of articles some years ago about Synanon and Daytop Village and Gateway in New York, the therapeutic communities for drug addicts. And Synanon was started by Chuck Dieterich, and they had a very, very sharply defined hierarchy there. The guy was at the top, and then his lieutenants, and then down, and they were constantly beating up on the people below them. And the problem with that was that the guys at the top never had anybody to talk back to them about their egos. There was never anybody who was given the opportunity to tell them the truth about themselves, which is the worst thing in the world that can happen to the likes of us. Dr. Vincent Dole was a non-alcoholic trustee, and about 25 years ago he retired from the General Service Board, and he said, "My concern for the future of Alcoholics Anonymous is that its principle of personal service may be eroded by money and professionalism." And unfortunately, a lot of that has happened. We got a lot of therapy talk in AA about feelings and where you're coming from and whatever the newest therapy of the moment is. Incidentally, did you hear about the Valium diet? You take four Valiums for breakfast and the food falls out of your mouth the rest of the day. Prozac, of course, is the newest wonder drug. If I have a doctor who tells me I need pills for my nervousness, I better find a new doctor. Because if I'm nervous or depressed or have any of these problems, symptoms of untreated alcoholism, the answer is to use the answer that was here all the time. And that's one of the things I have become increasingly aware of and firmer and firmer in my belief. It's a message from one amateur to another amateur. Tradition 8 is perhaps the tradition that has been most ignored in the last 25 years. The long form of Tradition 8 says that Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. We define professionalism as the occupation of counseling alcoholics for fees or hire. Now that's about as definite as you can get. On page 15 in the 12 and 12, it says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life will expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Healing means to take hope, to be made whole, and there is a healing in AA, both from the fellowship and the people, but certainly, importantly, from the continuing work with the 12 steps. I didn't start out to be an alcoholic. I started out to be a clean living American boy, and as you can see, something went wrong. I did some of my growing up in a little town down in South Georgia. The town was so dull that if you took LSD, you'd have had visions of Lawrence Welk. My father was a Lutheran minister. He was a PhD, was listed in Who's Who. My mother's father was a doctor of divinity, listed in Who's Who. I'm the only professional wrestler our family has ever produced. My father was also a drunk, and a very badly behaved drunk. And it finally got to a point when I was 12 years old that my mother, we were living in Oak Park, a Chicago suburb, and I was going to grammar school, and I was a very good student. And she decided she wanted either a separation or a divorce because she feared for her life. And my father, who was a very successful fundraiser, didn't want that to happen because it would have been bad for business. So he moved down to South Georgia where his sister was, and when I was 12, he picked me up coming home from school in Oak Park and drove almost nonstop down to South Georgia where he entered me in school. And I spent the next 7 years of my life down in Georgia. It was a very different environment, very nice people, as I came to understand in retrospect. But I couldn't make any sense out of anything. I had immense anger and fear and self-pity. You know, this is not exactly the childhood I had anticipated. One of the good things about it is it does make the rest of your life easy by comparison. But I found alcohol very young, even before I went down there. When I was 6 or 7 or 8, if somebody left a little wine or beer in a glass and nobody was looking, I'd snap up a gulp. I got down there when I was 12, and I used to pick the lock on my aunt's liquor closet, and I'd take a drink out of the whiskey bottle and add a little water and do that again. And when I was 14, I got drunk for the first time. And I remember that. Everything changed. This little town was Times Square, and every night was New Year's Eve. And gradually, I came to understand that I didn't have to get smart. I didn't have to get educated. All I needed was the price of what was in that bottle. And I drank my way through high school. I drank my way into one college and out and into another one. I was a good athlete, an increasingly bad student, and increasingly confused with everything. When I was sober, it would be as if there were not enough oxygen in the air. Or it would be as if I were sitting in a motion picture theater and the picture was out of focus and I couldn't find the control. So it would make sense. When I was 19, I came back up to Oak Park where my mother and brother and sister were. It was 1941. I was boxing for a club on the west side of Chicago and going to, I got my nose broken in 3 places, Georgia, Illinois, and California. And started college, and World War II had come along, and I decided to be a naval aviator. I'd never been in an airplane. But that was part of the act. Charlie touched on this last night. I had this character I would hold up there. You know, it was the athlete, it was the lover, it was the fighter, it was the drinker, the sophisticate. I had trouble sometimes remembering which part of the act I was in. But I started blacking out when I was 19, and I had a couple of automobile wrecks. And I went into service, and while I was a cadet, I could only get drunk on weekends. And then I got commissioned, and I could get drunk every night, which I did. I used to get drunk 9 nights in a row. 10th night, I'd have to go to bed about 6 o'clock, and I would stumble out in the morning. And I had a regular routine every morning. I would get up and take my gagging exercises, and I'd stumble down to the flight line, and I'd get in the airplane, and off I'd go. I flew single-engine seaplanes that were catapulted off cruisers and battleships. You went from 0 to 60 miles an hour in the space of about 45 feet. It wouldn't cure a hangover, but it really took your mind off of it for a little while. I destroyed 2 aircraft in World War II. They both belonged to the United States Navy. A friend of mine pointed out that if I'd gotten 3 more, I would have been a Japanese ace. A lot of weird things happened, and I didn't think too much of it. I was never in any bad trouble. But in the summer of 1945, I was 23 years old, and I got pneumonia, which went into DTs. So I was in the hospital. You know, I can never understand why people laugh at that. If I'd broken my back, you'd be hysterical. So I spent a month in the hospital, and I quit smoking, and I quit drinking, and I was in there for 4 weeks, and probably the last week, I went out and got drunk every night and started smoking again. We had a guy in there who was brought in about 3 o'clock in the morning. He was a pilot in the photo squadron, and he came in with a lady that we thought was his wife, and the next day his wife showed up, and it was somebody else. So throughout the rest of the time I was in the hospital, his wife and his girlfriend used to come visit him, and they never met. We figured that just shows that if you live right, the Lord will take care of you. I met a man in New York some years ago from Kentucky. He was celebrating 2 years of sobriety. He said, when I came on the program, I had a drinking problem and a marriage problem. AA straightened out my drinking problem. My sponsor ran off with my wife, which straightened out my marriage problem. He said, this program will work if you let it. So I continued stumbling along, sliding down the razor blade of life, and ended up at the Norfolk Naval Air Station at the end of the war. I thought about this afterwards, but we talk about alcoholics being sensitive people, and I realized that was true when I remembered an incident when I was at Norfolk. A friend of mine got me a blind date, and then I was starting to have a lot of trouble with my stomach. I was beginning to eat food that threw up easy so I wouldn't hurt myself, and we got drunk, and we were taking her home. I had to get out of the car and throw up. As I was walking her to the door, I had to stop and throw up. And then I was very hurt because she wouldn't kiss me goodnight. Well, the war had come to an end, and I ended up December 8th, 1945. I got separated at Great Lakes, just north of Chicago, traveled for 3 days and three nights and got home about 50 miles away. But actually, when I came into the Naval Air Station at Norfolk, the commander at personnel said, "You want to stay in for a while or get out?" I said, "I'd like to think about it." He said, "Well, come back in a couple of days." So 3 weeks later, they found me, and they decided I should get out, and I agreed with them. But I got home and was drinking, and I was going to go over to Cincinnati over New Year's that year, and I ended up drunk in Milwaukee for 3 days. I was born in Milwaukee. I guess I wanted to see what happened. And I ended up with what had to be the worst-looking woman in the Middle West. She frightened me into 6 weeks of sobriety. She reminded me of my judo instructor, except he didn't have a mustache. She looked like $1 million, and the only reason I say that is because I've never seen $1 million, and she looked like something I never saw before. So I decided to do a little boxing, and that didn't work very well. One night I went out with a friend of mine. We were going up to the air station in Glenview to fly, and the field closed in with a snowstorm, and we went into Chicago to drink, and he passed out. He lived about 35 miles west of Chicago. And so I started driving him home, and I would stop in a bar and ask for directions as I bought a bottle of beer. And by the time the beer was gone, I had forgotten the directions, and I would stop at another one. And I went in this one bar, and there was a large dog on the floor, and I said hello, and the dog bit me on the leg. I didn't think much of it, and a couple of days later, I went to the doctor because somewhere that night I'd gotten my nose broken. I mentioned by accident that I'd been bitten by this dog, and he was quite concerned. He said, "You go find that dog." So I went to all the saloons along North Avenue. I said, "Have you got a dog that bit me the other night?" And of course, nobody had. So I ended up taking rabies shots for 2 weeks. Just to be on the safe side, I made out a list of people to bite in case they didn't work. But I was starting to have an awful lot of bad luck. And I began to read those books that'll tell you how to straighten out your life. At that time, there was one by Rabbi Liebman called Peace of Mind. And it was very inspiring, and I was very inspired. I thought, this is going to change my life. And then I found out that Liebman committed suicide, and I thought, that's more change than I need at the moment. And I read a book by Dorothea Brandy called Wake Up and Live. She said, act as if it's impossible to fail. You ever try that on the dry heaves? I read a book by a New York psychiatrist. He said we become alcoholics because we have too much pressure on our brains. Well, I knew there was a lot of pressure on my brain because something was shoving all the hair out of my scalp. So I wrote him a letter to see if there's anybody around Chicago who could do a spinal tap, which would relieve the pressure, and then I wouldn't be an alcoholic. And he didn't know anybody, so I continued to bought some more books and drank some more, and my life was just a pathetic mess. You know, I can laugh about it now. It was not funny at the time because I couldn't understand what to do. But if you came up to me and said, you're in trouble, your life is just in terrible shape, I would have laughed and said, no, I know what I'm doing. I enjoy this. I had a variety of stupid jobs. If I took more than half an hour for lunch, they had to retrain me. And I never lost any good jobs from drinking because I never had any good jobs. But in January of 1947, I went on the wagon. And I knew I was an alcoholic, and I knew that if you're an alcoholic, you shouldn't take one drink. And I had watched my father drink. I had watched what it had done to people around him. For a long time, I said, well, that's never going to happen to me. And then it was happening to me. And so I went on the wagon in January of 1947, and I stayed sober 3 months. I knew I was an alcoholic. And I knew that I could not take one drink, and I thought, this is all I need. And in April of 1947, I went to a party, and I asked for a plain ginger ale, and they put a shot in it, and I thought, well, I'll jump back on the wagon tomorrow. I'll get drunk tonight. And I got drunk that night, and then I couldn't find the wagon the next day, and I chased it all over Chicago for the next 4 months. And in August of 1947, I got drunk again, and I got a great gift. It was the gift of honesty. I could no longer lie about what was happening to my life and the condition I was in. No longer was all this brilliant stupidity with which I larded my life able to work. And I was sober for a week, and I kept thinking, well, maybe I can do it on my own, and this time it'll be different. And a voice would always say, that's not going to happen. So sober a week, I called AA on a Saturday morning. I talked to a lady in the Chicago office, and she said, are you home? I said, no, I called from a drugstore. I didn't want anybody to know I had a drinking problem. And she said, well, you go home, and somebody will call you. And a man called me pretty soon after that, and I went to see him. And the next day, he took me to a meeting at the Sunday morning breakfast on the west side of Chicago. And I walked out of that meeting, and I haven't had a drink since. Something happened. Some people I'd never seen before in my life reached out their hands and said, how can we help? And every day of my life since then, you people have helped me over and over and over, frequently in spite of myself. I can look back and I can see those as the hand of God. But I have to remember when that new person shows up with that frightened, shaking hand, this too is the hand of God. And if gratitude is more than a word with me, I will be here and in the kind of condition that enables me to pass on to that person which you people gave me. So I started going to meetings and did nothing with the steps because nobody showed me what to do and I couldn't figure it out for myself. In our group, we don't wait for people to ask questions. Because if I could have figured out the questions, I could probably have figured out the answers. But when somebody comes in, we say, this is what we do, this is the program, and we want to help you do this. And if you don't want to do it, God bless you. But that's what it says in chapter 7, Working with Others. It says, having had the experience of working the steps, you can be helpful to that new person. In our group, men work with men and women work with women for obvious reasons. But we get the person working the steps just the way they did when Bill and Bob and Paul Stanley and the rest of those guys sobered up, which is why we have a tremendously healthy, vigorous group. We don't talk about any theories on the steps. Each meeting that we have, each person comments, somebody who leads the meeting pretty well runs itself, and the leader picks out the next week's leader for the secretary from a list, an alphabetical list. And the person talks from his or her experience, and then we go around for comments. And everybody is urged to talk only about what he really knows about the step and what he's really done with it. Because we found that when you talk about what you really know in AA, it does not take very long at all. I heard about a woman whose husband died, and she had him cremated, and she brought the ashes home. She spread them out on the kitchen table and then mixed them up with marijuana, rolled them up in a cigarette and smoked them, and she said that's the first time in 30 years he made her feel good. You probably heard about the man who went into the bar and he said, give me three drinks. So the bartender lined up three shots on the bar and turned away for a minute, and the man had drunk all three. And he said, you sure drink in a hurry. The man said, well, you drink in a hurry too if you had what I've got. The bartender said, what have you got? He said, 40 cents. So when I work with a person in AA, we start with step one, and then we talk about step two as honesty and sanity being synonymous. Probably every bit of problems I've had in my life, drunk or sober, started with dishonesty. And if I lie, cheat, or steal, there's no way in the world I'm going to get sane in my life, or I'm really going to be able to understand the program. Then we take step three aloud together, as it says on page 63 in the big book, and then we get them started with a fourth step. Now there's all kinds of guides. The Hazelden guide, it's very complicated. If I use it, my remaining hairs would plunge to the floor. But we use the big book and we use the 12 and 12. Using headings, as the 12 and 12 says, the seven deadly sins, pride, lust, anger, envy, greed, sloth, gluttony. In addition, resentments, self-pity, fear. We suggest that he make his first inventory as thorough as possible, understanding that he has got the rest of his life to continue to do these inventories. And then if he wants me to take a fifth step with him, I swap a fifth step with him. We take steps 6 and 7 at that point. And then I sit with him while he writes out his eighth step. And what I've discovered is, and many of us have, is that it's not possible to find all of my amends off my resentment list, because I have found it quite easy to treat people badly and not resent them. So I make a separate 8-step, and then I bug him till he goes ahead and makes his amends. I didn't see my father for many years. I left Georgia in 1941, and after I got sober, I came to the realization that if you've got an important relationship like that in your life, you're never going to be healthy until it's healthy. And I used to call him up. He got sober on his own, some friends told me. I used to call him up and suggest we get together, and he didn't want to do that. He had a lot of guilt, as he should have. And I think I could make an honest case that 99% of the harm in that relationship had been done by him. But I also came to understand that logic was not enough. So I went to see him unannounced in October of 1968. I hadn't seen him then for 27 years, and I was sober 21. And I rang the doorbell, and he came to the door. He still lived in that little town down in South Georgia. I made an amend to him, and then I told him who I was. I said, I'd like to come in and talk with you, and he said, come in. And I went back to see him in March of 69, a few months later, again unannounced, and again spent about 25 minutes talking with him. And these were very painful visits, all kinds of things. Those growing up years were extremely painful, and I don't even know what I was reacting to. But 2 weeks after that visit, on Easter Sunday, he died, and I went to his funeral. Keenly aware that easy does not always do it, and very grateful that I had been to see him when I had. But those visits, with all the pain that was involved in it, were very, very healing for me. And before that, I had talked about it, and I had prayed about it, and I had whined about it, and all kinds of things. I never could get a handle on it to change that situation until I went and made those amends. I think that's one of the many differences between the AA program, the 12 steps, and any kind of therapy I've ever heard anything of. I did a lot of writing. Hobart Maurer, the psychologist at Illinois, had 2 grants from the Eli Lilly Foundation. In 1965, 66, and 67, I was on his board of directors. And it was with a number of, I was one of 2 non-professionals. And there were a number of psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, clergymen. One of the guys on there was Dr. William Glasser, who wrote Reality Therapy years ago. He was a California psychiatrist. And all of these men had once believed in therapy, and none of them did anymore. And Glasser said a couple of things I've always remembered. One was that if all the therapists disappeared today, it wouldn't make any difference, because people would find somebody else to talk to tomorrow. And the other was, when you pay a therapist, you're buying a friend. And in AA, you taught me right at the beginning, we don't sell friendship. We give it away as the price of our own recovery. Careful, I'll get Charlie after you. But we give it as the price of our own recovery. Years ago, I was having terrible financial problems, and somebody said, try tithing. You give 10% of your income to charity. Well, at that time, 10% of nothing wouldn't have hurt me much. So I started doing that, and I found it very helpful in leveling out my income. I think that's something I need to do, and that's something I try to do in terms of step 10. I think, obviously, if I harm somebody, then I'm supposed to do something about it. But I think that as part of a daily inventory, I can see what I'm doing with my time and my energy, with my money, and also what am I doing physically to stay in decent condition. So that's part of what I do with my daily 10th step. I started meditating when I was sober 2 years. I was not able to meditate until I had done the first 9 steps. And I sat and did some things like Thy Will Be Done or God is Love, trying to quiet down my mind for maybe 15 minutes or 20 minutes a day. And then I got involved in all those books that tell you how to use prayer to get your own way. Boy, I thought, this is terrific. And I started doing all those things that would get me my own way. And then quite a while later, I took a very good look at step 11. And it said, praying only for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. I ran across a quote from Meister Eckhart, who certainly knew something about prayer. He said, when I pray for something, I do not pray. When I pray for nothing, I really pray. And I simply take a word like God or love or something like that and bring my mind back to it again and again and again. I wasn't looking for God, and I wasn't looking for the spiritual life when I came to AA. I simply wanted to find a way to stay sober and continue to do whatever it was I'd been doing. And I gradually came to the realization that it doesn't work that way. But the spiritual life is the only life that's real. You know, I flail around and have spent my life trying to make money and be important. None of it means anything in retrospect or at the time. And as I clean up the past, I can live better in the present and understand the truth of God's will for me, which turns out really to be very simple. We've had through the years a lot of people come to our area who are suffering from untreated alcoholism, some of them with 15, 20, 25, 30 years. We had a guy come in there 10 years ago from Toronto. He's sober 24 years and out of his mind. Very, very active, a lot of meetings, a lot of activity, a lot of conferences. And what we do is the person comes in with an inventory, and if he needs help with it, we help him do the inventory and improve it. And we swap fifth steps with him. He goes to a hotel, and 8 or 9 people from our group go over through Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And in the swapping of the fifth step, he learns a lot more about what needs to be done. He learns a lot more about his inventory. Listening to these other men, he learns a lot more and invariably goes home with a list of amends that he needs to make. And this guy came over from Toronto crazy, and he went back and he had an amend to make that he'd been aware of for a long time and he could never do, but he had a lot of other amends that he was not doing anything about. And we said, make the amends you can find, and this other one, I'm sure you'll get a chance to do it. And he had tried to find a lady that he had made pregnant before AA, and he just abandoned her. And he made all the other amends, and one day he was in Brampton, Ontario, at an exhibit. This woman came up and tapped him on the shoulder, and it was her. And they had lunch, and he made his amend. We had a man come down to our meeting from Madison, Wisconsin, 6 years ago. At that time, he was sober 22 years. He was a Christian brother, had been. He got out, got married, got divorced, and he was an alcoholism counselor. And he called me up, and he knew me from somewhere, and he said, you know, I want to kill myself. He said, I think that's a bad sign. I said, well, I think I'd have to agree with you. So it was a Wednesday. He drove down from Madison, which is about a four-hour round trip, and we helped him do an inventory, and then we went through his 8-step, showed him what to put there. And he started coming to our meeting for about 2 years. Every Wednesday night, he would drive 4 hours round trip. He swapped a bunch of fifth steps, made a whole bunch of amends, and everything straightened out for him. I just saw him a couple of weeks ago. He came down to the meeting. But over and over and over, we have worked with people that way with tremendously effective results for them. And none of that would work if any of us were making money out of it. I think that when we help another person, there is a spiritual transaction that takes place, and both of us get better. If money is involved, that spiritual transaction will never take place. We've had a lot of people who've done that. A guy that I knew slightly for 15 years. In January of 72, he sobered up again. He'd been around AA 15 years, never stayed sober. This time he began to work the 12 steps, and guess what happened? He's been sober ever since, but not just sober, he's been in good shape. And we've had all kinds of people, as I say, come from all over the U.S. and Canada. And they've all benefited from that weekend because it has a tremendously positive effect in helping them to get better, and of course it helps us too. Clint incidentally stopped over a year or two ago and had the same results. Rabbi Zusia was a Hasidic scholar, was a great admirer of Moses, and he was constantly berating himself because he fell short of his idol. And one night in his sleep a voice said, "When you die you will not be asked, why were you not Moses? You'll be asked, why were you not Zusia? All I'm responsible for is what I can do with what I've got, and the help of all you people and the help of the 12 steps." It's been said that there are 3 ranges to the spiritual life. The first is a change in conduct. I simply begin to behave as I am supposed to behave. I don't lie, cheat, or steal. I don't hate people. The second is a change in character. We become that kind of a person, and we do that automatically. And the third is a change in consciousness where we understand a level of truth which is blocked to us otherwise. And unfortunately, with 15 years of sobriety and working the steps, I still find myself in the first range. I'm still trying to behave as I should. I believe what it says in the 12 and 12 on page 15. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles which, practiced as a way of life, will enable the sufferer to stay sober and become happily and usefully whole. It's all here. The message, I understand, is summed up in the experience of a man that I knew who was around AA for perhaps a dozen years and went to many meetings and never worked the steps. And one day in January of 71, he sobered up. This time, with a difference, he came to our meeting and he began to work the steps. He had three sons. The youngest was 8 years old, and because of the father's behavior, the boy was in a class for retarded children. He simply couldn't learn. And that year in 71, as the father worked the steps and changed, the boy went from a class for retarded children to a regular class doing average work. And as the father continued to stay sober and change, the boy did better and better. When the son graduated from high school at the age of 18, I had lunch with his father. I said, "How did your boy do in high school?" He said, "Well, he made the honor roll every grade period but one. He was a varsity football player." And the father said, "None of this would have happened if all I had done is stay sober and not work the steps." And that's the message I understand that you and I have to experience and to share with others. Not just a dried-up drunk, but if you and I will continue to work and rework every one of these 12 steps, we will change, and that change will be reflected in the lives of everyone with whom we come in contact. I learned that from you, and I'm still with you, because without your help, I would forget it. Thank you very much.